Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the 14th episode. Wild Trekker is a series of 50-minute podcasts, a writer's notebook, audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, and jam sessions. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. That's one of my musical compositions, Sailing with Whales. I wanted to call to mind a voyage at sea, with whales blowing at the surface and moaning in the depths as a sailing ship advances through the waves. This composition is meant to evoke the unity of life, and I don't mean this in some purely poetical or metaphysical sense. On the contrary, today's podcast has to do with molecular biology. October 7th, 2002 stands out in my memory because on that day I was flying from Cyprus to London for CBC Radio to interview a leading scientist at Cambridge University. At the airport newsstand in Larnaca, Cyprus, just before boarding in the early hours of the morning, I picked up a copy of the Financial Times. I read that the Nobel Prize in Medicine would be awarded that very day. Now this news put me into a bit of a panic, because it suddenly occurred to me that the scientist I was interviewing later that day, Sir John Salston, could very well win the Nobel Prize himself, which would surely put our interview on ice. Was I flying all this way for nothing then? I had good rapport with Sir John, and had met him and corresponded with him previously. Still, I raced to a public telephone as soon as we landed at London and called the Sanger Center at Cambridge, where he was working, to confirm the interview. To my amazement, I managed to get through to him. "Yes, that's fine, George. I'm expecting you," he said. "But what happens if you're awarded the Nobel Prize today?" I asked. He laughed. "Right, George. See you later." On reaching the Sanger Center in Hingston outside Cambridge, I saw a crowd of TV cameras, boom mics, and reporters all gathered at the front door, waiting to interview someone. I must have been right then. The Nobel Foundation must have announced that Sir John was getting a share of the Nobel Prize. He told his assistant to make sure I got through the crowd waiting outside and got the first interview, which was very gracious of him. "Well, we had our prior arrangement," he said. "It's only fair to give you the interview before the others."
So congratulations. I feel like something of a prophet here because I called you just this morning and said, if you win the Nobel Prize, won't that bounce our meeting or something?
That's right. And I said, what Nobel Prize? Because I didn't know anything about it. I really didn't. In fact, you're not the first one. There was somebody else that I was talking to just the end of last week who mailed me and said, you're very good at keeping a secret. I have to get to mail him back and say, I had no idea.
What do you feel is the significance of this Nobel Prize?
I think it's as so often with the Nobel Committee, it's very firmly about fundamental work. It's saying that something was built up by Sidney Brenner and the group he drew around him that has really contributed very heavily to our understanding of the mechanism of our own bodies. And it's interesting to look at the water that flowed under the bridge since then. I think what we've learned, it was only guessed at then, but what we've learned very clearly is what a unity of life there is, how the mechanisms that we've uncovered it, or we began to uncover in those days in the worm, are found in our own bodies. And the reason for the citation is that genes that control cell death pathways in the nematode are also found in humans, and they're therefore very important medically, of course, because if they go wrong, then they cause trouble, either by cancer or degeneration or whatever. And so I think they're showing that they've taken a very long view of the work and recognized for the first time the worm, which has contributed, as we knew it was, a lot.
The lily nematode.
The little nematode, yeah.
Now, do you think that you've mentioned in your book recently, The Common Thread, which you wrote with Georgina Ferry, that you recognize the importance to take public stands and to inform the public, to communicate with the public about the issues at stake, scientific issues, issues of ethics, and accessibility to scientific knowledge?
Yes, go on.
What's the question? The question is, does this give you yet more visibility in a sense where you can address a larger audience about some of these very crucial issues?
Ah, I see. Yes. I've often commented in the past about people who get Nobel Prizes and immediately jump off their rails and go off after some crazy thing. I think I jumped off my rails a little while ago, actually, and went off after, actually, I don't think it's a crazy thing, but it's certainly not something which I'm professional at, which is to comment on ethics and politics, as I do. And I don't know, it's interesting. I guess I excuse myself by saying I learned something about these issues and their urgency while I was working on the human genome. And it seems to me important to try and say something. Now, whether it really makes any difference having the prize, I rather doubt, because the prize is about science. And I think, in a sense, it almost makes me realize it's the science that matters. And I mustn't sort of imagine that somehow this is a license to megaphone. But nevertheless, if people carry on listening and are happy to discuss, because I like dialogue, not monologue, then I'm going to be more than pleased.
Now, the Human Genome Project, you've taken a leading role in directing it from the British end for several years, and then you step back a little bit from that. And you've always said that you believe that the human genome is the heritage of humanity.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think it is. In fact, I know it is. The question is, what do we do about that? Do we say that it's a heritage which we can nevertheless divide up and have people owning chunks? Or is it a heritage that we're going to preserve as a common good? And it's a question that we have to ask ourselves in all sorts of areas. It's just that that's the particular one that I got involved in. And it's an age-old battle. It's the the battle of the commons. And I think right now the pendulum has swung too far towards the idea that we can solve everything by ownership. And I think that, but I think I do detect signs of it swinging back. There is recognition that we cannot level the world playing field. We cannot bring ourselves to a just and peaceful and indeed wealthy condition without taking account of the commons of humanity. The human genome is definitely one of those.
Now, the Sanger Center here in the United Kingdom has been working together with Americans and French and another number of other groups to sequence the entire human genome and also the mouse genome and other genomes. What is the significance, do you think, for in the human genome sequencing itself? What do you think it's likely to lead to?
It's very much like this work that we're discussing with the worm lineage that was done in the 70s. It's absolutely fundamental. It will lead, in a sense, to everything, but only through a lot of work by other people. I mean, take one good midterm example, because there are things that are happening immediately now, like diagnosis. There are things that won't happen for a long time, like most forms of gene therapy. A good midterm one is the work on cancer. The work that's being done on cancer by the Cancer Screening Group here under Mike Stratton is using the information from the human genome to look systematically through tumours and find out what's wrong with them in the genetic sense. Because the important thing about a tumour is that its DNA is altered. It's not that there is something else wrong with it. We know that the DNA is altered. The cells carry on behaving in a different way. They've lost. They're not responding to the signals that say stop growing from the body. Now, if we can find out for any particular tumour which particular genes have gone awry, which particular genes it needs to keep growing and destroying the patient, then we can hopefully, very likely, in due course make drugs to stop it, or maybe antibodies, or maybe some other means for getting at those positions. But the point is, what you're doing this way is to find targets. You're searching now in a systematic way with the full knowledge of the human genome. But now, it's not that it comes out automatically from the human genome. The data is there for people to use. Mike Stratton's group finds the targets. It then requires years, maybe decades, of dedicated work by large groups of people in pharmaceuticals to find the actual cures. So you see, what you have to say over and over again, this is a beginning. It's the beginning of everything, and yet itself is nothing until it's transferred into real useful practice by these other people.
Now, if you are able to unveil the 30,000 some genome genes of the human genome and the 3 billion bases, are you able to sort of reveal all the mechanisms of the genetic functioning of a human being?
No, that's the point. Not at all. It's just the beginning. The you're looking at a static situation of the information which we can only read out imperfectly. We have to read it out more perfectly. And the hard part is finding the control things. It's not just the products of the genes, but what controls them, which are really tiny, subtle bits of sequence that proteins come along and bind to and switch them on and off. But then even more difficult conceptually is to understand how all of these substances being produced in the cell cause it to have an architecture, cause it to behave in certain ways, cause it to interact with other cells, each cell becoming different, the process of differentiation. It's a huge task. Some people have said it's impossible. I think it's clearly not impossible because organisms can do it, and therefore we're going to understand it. But it requires a huge amount of understanding of the parallel processing of the cell to do it. And I think what we shall have to do probably is to invent higher and higher levels of looking at it. We already do that a bit in developmental biology. For example, we often refer to cells talking to each other. We're taking the cell itself for granted and assuming it works like a little factory all by itself. And then we're just thinking about the interactions between cells. And that's how we shall do it. That's how we shall understand ourselves, is to isolate the key steps and not worry too much about the things that are going on. So you understand the series of levels as you go along. So I think it's extremely exciting. But again, it's just the starting point now.
If the cells consist of machinery, if the genome works as a kind of mechanism, very, very complex mechanism, or programming, is the human being, at least from the physiological point of view, a machine of sorts?
Oh, yes, it is. It's a very beautiful machine, very complex machine, but it is a machine. That's what we mean by understanding, and it's very proper to call it that. It just sometimes is misunderstood as being too simple, you know, just like a simple couple of gear wheels or something, and of course it's much more than that. I think it's useful to think about the word program as well. The point about complex programs is that they have iterative loops, and that those will trigger new bits of the program. It's not a simple A to B process. It's a pathway going through a whole series of processes. Complex computer programs are like that anyway. That's why computers crash, because it's not the computer that's crashed. It's because the program that it's running has got itself in a position that wasn't anticipated by the designer, because the designer couldn't anticipate all the possibilities. So what we're looking at is a complex unfolding of the information in the genome through a computational process which is expressed in the physical properties of the molecules which it generates. That's what the problem we have to solve.
But in your book, The Common Thread, you also defended towards the end the uniqueness of each human being, that the program per se cannot be applied universally in all its aspects.
Yes, you're quite right, and thank you. That's a very important point, is that, of course, in the course of this unfolding, the program is also interacting with the environment. And the case, very, very, very importantly with human beings, it's thinking. It's actually producing a thinking machine. And that machine is thinking about itself, and it's learning and combining what it learns into new patterns. The thoughts, the ideas, the observations are combined into new patterns. So what happens is that we end up with a probably fully unpredictable situation, because exactly what we think or do at any particular moment is at the very least down to chance. But nevertheless, I think we shall... And the question is whether it's down to free will. And there you have to say, well, do I believe that there is something else apart from the machine? Or is this sense of being a self-conscious person with free will that says, I am, is it just what it feels like to be such a very complex machine? I find the second quite a satisfying explanation. But clearly, if one really, really understands how one works, it might be a little hard to live with for us. But it won't be so hard for our children's children, because in their generation, I think, people will have got to that position of understanding, and they're going to say, fine, that's what it feels like, so now I'm going to go on and be a really fine human being anyway.
But those questions are not really within the boundaries of science.
I think it's very doubtful whether I don't think you should say they're in or out the boundaries of science. I think science is a part of our culture. I think science, like all of philosophy, should know no boundaries. It should inquire wherever it can. But it should also, and perhaps this is what your point means, it should interact with all the other branches as well, so that anybody who has something good to say, to bring forward, should be there discussing with everybody else. You know, I do think that as science gets more complicated, as it's clearly dealing with things that affect us more as people, more as personalities, then we are going to recognize the softness of those boundaries. And I think this is very exciting. There's kind of maybe come back to a kind of unity of knowledge, a bit like the Enlightenment, although I think at the time of the Enlightenment, people perhaps believed rather heavily in the sort of clockwork view of it. And I think what we're going to come back to is a unity where we see the uncertainty, the fuzziness of it all, and nevertheless, we're not going to say science belongs in this box and another kind of philosophy belongs in a different part. We're going to bring them together.
In your book, you also described the words being put together of the human genome.
The words.
The letters, the four letters form words.
Yes, I mean, one uses these analogies. I mean, the point about the digital code of the genome, the four letters, is that they do have a very compelling similarity to a language. I think they have an even more compelling similarity actually to computer code in a way, simply because it's relatively simple. It's binary, this is quaternary. But you can sort of think in terms of words and chapters if you like, because the information is divided up into chunks corresponding the genes, the individual units of instruction. And so there is, again, rather a compelling sort of sense of a library of information there. So, yes, I think these are not bad analogies, but we should always remember they're analogies. They're, as you get into understanding it, you sort of recognise the logic to have a quality of its own rather than having to lean on the analogies so much.
Well, when I read that in your book, I thought in a funny kind of way that it reminded me of In the Beginning Was the Word. But that's a different setting, a spiritual setting. It's not the same thing.
Yes, I think that's a story. And I certainly wouldn't take that literally, because I don't think the analogy literally, because after all, in the beginning was not DNA. Well, in the beginning of life there was DNA, but not in the beginning of the Earth, as far as we know. There was no DNA there then. So this word, as described biblically, is another kind of language again.
Now, could you tell me a little bit about your drive to develop a scientific equivalent of the Hippocratic Oath? As we look around us, we see in medical science a lot of conflicts of interest which remain undeclared, which if we knew to what extent some medical researchers are getting paid, coming and going for work that they're doing, this would certainly cast doubt on the results of their research. And why is it important to have a kind of scientific equivalent of the Hippocratic Oath for you?
Yes, I did mention the Hippocratic Oath in one article. I'm not sure whether that's the right solution, but I certainly think it's worth discussing. I think there does need to be a reaffirmation of the communality of science. I think that if we all try and own, in some formal sense, all our discoveries, all of our results right away, rather than letting them be freely shared and then be very specific that if we make any invention out of those results, then we're entitled to a measure of ownership. These things are all getting very much tangled up, and I think there is a spread of secrecy and of overclaiming in science, which is of some concern. What happens in practice is that scientists know each other. Scientists trust those who trust them and behave in a trusting manner. And the result is that I think it goes on functioning. But I think it's very worthwhile discussing whether we should have a more formal, professional set of standards. And I think there is some move towards that through a series of regulations that are coming in, recognition that journals have some duty towards their readers to investigate fraud properly, that labs have a duty, and so forth. The difficulty is, of course, if one does it, it goes too far through rule-based system rather than keeping it as a professional thing, then of course it all gets very policed and everybody gets in a tangled mess of these codes. So I'm not quite sure where it's going, but I think what's very clear is that we do have to go on behaving in a trustworthy way, most of us. Otherwise, it's just not going to work. The system won't work at all.
Now, you've been working in the field for several decades now, and I'm sure that you've had years that were frustrating, ungrateful, and sometimes rather dark and lonely. How would you characterize your underlying deep down motivation to keep pushing ahead with huge projects like the Human Genome Project, which were politically, economically, scientifically extremely complex, involving many institutions, many individuals, and sometimes extremely severe conflicts between different interest groups. How did you keep going, and what has been your underlying motivation? What have you tried to achieve through these years?
I think it built up. I think that if I'd come into the human genome suddenly with the conflicts over ownership, for example, then I wouldn't have reacted in quite the same way, because I wouldn't have had a strong foundation. What happened looking back is that right in the beginning, in the early 80s, when I and Alan Coulson and Bob Waterston started to do the worm map, is that we realized as a practical way forward that we had to promote very strongly a sharing culture. This came naturally to me anyway. I was very happy about that. I'd always done that with joined in the LMB and the worm community generally in the sharing culture. But this time it was more specific, because what we had to do in order to make the genome project work, and this is really the early days, it's not even sequencing, certainly not human. In order to make it work, we had to have the central labs, the genome labs, just two of them, completely transparent. If they were transparent, then what would happen is that the other labs, all of the community, would trust them with their data, because we were not going to steal anything. We were not going to use the genome data in some way that was just beneficial to us. And so we developed, in a very formal way, this sharing principle. And we followed the rules. We made sure that we didn't sort of improperly communicate one person's bit of data to another. We were really acting as a sort of central telephone exchange, and we had to be careful. And the result of that, building up year after year and really realizing how powerfully it was going forward, because you're combining genetic and biological data on the one hand with physical data from the DNA on the other, you're building up a structure which is enormously powerful. And everybody was happy about this. And so when it came to the human, I remember I wrote into the proposal for the Sanger Center, this lab, very specifically, I said, we would like to bring this ethos into the human because we think it would be a good thing. And that's exactly what we did. So it was the learning experience that it worked pragmatically, not simply a theoretical moral stance, that sort of powered me to carry on pushing it through the human. And of course, it's having the right colleagues, Bob Waterston there all the way through, the pair of us. Neither one of us, I suspect, would have done it on our own.
But in your commitment to make genome information accessible to people in developing countries where they have very low incomes, isn't there compassion for the less favored?
There is, absolutely. But what I like to say also, again, is it's pragmatic, because that, I think, is persuasive. I think that those who imagine that they can continually and further enrich themselves at the expense of others in the world are simply foolish. It's not going to work. They're going to cause mayhem. And so I think that we can use the joint motives of compassion and pragmatism to drive forward a more equitable world politics.
Thank you very much, John, and congratulations once again.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed talking once again.
I would like to mention a few things about the work Sir John Selston did, along with Robert Horvitz and Sidney Brenner. The nematode worm is not closely related to earthworms. Actually, the nematode is a multicellular creature, only about 1 millimeter long, with some striking similarities to humans. There are altogether 25,000 species of nematode around the world, on mountains, in deserts, in ocean trenches, and as parasites on plants. Some 35 species of nematodes are found within our own human bodies. There are about 60 billion nematodes per human on the face of the Earth, and they are most frequently encountered in the tundra regions of the Arctic and subarctic, in the boreal forest, and in the alpine zone of mountains. The particular nematode Sir John Selston studied is C. elegans, which consists of hermaphrodites, individuals with both male and female reproduction systems, as well as a few rare males. C. elegans makes a very effective model organism for us to study. Why? because it reproduces about 1,000 eggs per day, can easily be acquired, stored, frozen, and thawed out for further research, and because about 35% of C. elegans genes have human homologs, meaning these genes are roughly comparable and point to our common origin ages upon ages ago. This nematode and humans have almost identical neurons. Since C. elegans is a model organism, studying its genome helps to answer many questions about the human genome. This really speaks to the unity of life. We have so much in common with other life forms on planet Earth. Sir John Sulston was director of the British side of the Human Genome Project, a $3 billion project over 13 years involving scientists from 20 countries. The British side of the project was funded by the Wellcome Trust and sequenced almost one-third of the human genome, focusing on chromosomes 1, 6, 9, 10, 11, 13, 20, and X. The Human Genome Project made its results publicly accessible and was competing with a private venture based in the United States, which was patenting the genes it discovered. Here are some of the insights I gained from my interactions with Sir John Sulston. Basic research is extremely important. It should be public, openly accessible, and rigorous. Here are some of the insights I gained from my interactions with Sir John Sulston. He made clear to me that basic research is extremely important. It should be public, openly accessible, and rigorous. Sir John Sulston also told me entrepreneurs and even public organizations around the world that focus on direct, short-term economic benefits are likely to hype what they're doing and sometimes even distort their findings, which can create false expectations. Sir John considered the human genome as the heritage of humanity and not something to be broken down into genes that can be patented and controlled by private interests. He told me the Human Genome Project will, over the course of time, provide many benefits, but not always in the ways pioneering scientific researchers expect. It's hard to predict the outcomes of scientific discovery. You just have to keep at it. Sir John Sulston told me many scientists are publicly funded, which means they depend for their livelihood on the taxes the public pays. In return, they owe the public 10% to 15% of their time by sharing their work with the public, raising awareness, taking part in community meetings, and spreading their scientific knowledge and insights as broadly as possible. He also told me the Bible offers many stories rich in myth and metaphor. But Sir John Sulston was not a religious person. On the contrary, he was an atheist. For him, scientific endeavor is completely different from religion and is based on the rigorous search for and understanding of evidence. Attempts to harmonize religion and science involve a lot of rhetorical positioning and should be avoided. But he did tell me in one conversation that he felt like an archaeologist, somewhere in the Middle East, perhaps in Mesopotamia, uncovering clay tablets from thousands of years ago and figuring out how to decipher them to reach the key meanings that had been lost for so long. The human genome was exactly this kind of code. For molecular biologists, he told me in one conversation, the unity of life is a practical reality. It is something very easy to demonstrate, and the comparisons from one species to another, especially from model organisms to humans, can lead to breakthrough diagnostics and therapeutics. It's very rewarding work. Sir John Sulston died in 2018. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net. And Evidencia is spelled E-V-I-D-E-N, as in normal, T-I-A, Evidencia. That's Latin for evidence. You can also check out my Facebook page, which is called Evidencia Channel. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wild Trekker podcast is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Desmeules on the guitar. Let's get together soon. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2020, George Toombs. All rights reserved.